Do you all have art hanging up in your offices? That's it. That's the question.
Good
job. All right. So what you I got? Think this will take us about 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. We'll give it a go. Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 326 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and my left earbud doesn't work.
I'm Sam, and I'm the artist.
Yeah, this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is August 26th, 2021. Dunk on everyone. And before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity in this show. So, you know, that's going to be good.
It's going to be real good profanity. So buckle your pants.
Also, we'd like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We got an anonymous donation, which is very brave.
Or is it,
you know,
or is it intimidating?
I want to know, what line of work are you in that you have to anonymously donate to this podcast?
Is it a threat? Maybe it's a threat of some sort.
Yeah, what's the message? Is there a message attached?
There's no message. Just a completely silent, anonymous. Someone was like, I don't want to be
can't be traced back publicly.
It's anonymous.
We are approaching October. It's appropriately spooky, you know.
It might have been a skeleton. Ooh. You don't – who knows who it was?
Maybe it was a ghost with its last sort of little burst of whatever. It's
ghost goo.
Ectoplasm electricity thing that all the various movies they have, you know. Because like, they get into electronics. Because the ghost's whole thing is they're like good with electronics, which is funny because of how most ghosts are. They're always like they can interact with like they can make sounds appear in a recording or whatever, right? But it's just because like they interact with electronics.
Yeah, and it's like, Jerry, you had a problem operating your touchscreen iPhone. Yeah. I don't believe you.
I mean, most ghosts
interface.
Let's face it, most ghosts, those are from people who are not familiar with electronic technology.
Yeah, it's usually older. Yeah.
And they always have frilly clothes on. They're always Victorian. They probably don't know shit about VCRs.
I feel like that was more of a ghost fashion trend in the 90s was more of the like – the sort of fluffy, like Victorian era clothing. I'm not sure now.
Will there be
a trend in ghost fashion?
So, 50 years from now, will ghost fashion be like skinny jeans and V-necks? So.
Yeah, I would imagine it would be. It better be. Otherwise, I mean,
all the hipster ghosts are going to be coming out.
They'll be 50 years. Yeah, it'll be as you're making your avocado toast 50 years from now, your avocado will like roll off the table.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you'll look up and there'll be a V-neck ghost in skinny jeans. Yep.
Though
licking their lips, being like, "We got any?
You know, there's
guac."
There's an interesting real estate question when it comes to you know more of the millennial aged ghosts, though, right? Which is like, what if the boomer ghosts are still sort of like you know absorbing a lot of like the real estate side of things.
Oh, right. Is there a ghost economy going on?
Yeah. So like, are the millennials not like, are we going to sort of be hearing just millennials complain, but outside the house actually? Because
millennials are just going to be the next boomers, right?
I mean, eventually, yeah.
There's a lot of millennials and it's not going to, I mean, it's already starting, but it's not going to be too long before, you know, what's the next generation? There's like Zoomers? Mm-hmm. Or is that Z? Are they the same?
I think it's the same.
Either way, like, they're already kind of mad at the millennials. You know, it's, you know, the it always goes both directions.
Yep.
Right? Like, the older generation's like, these fucking kids, like, they don't know anything and they can't do anything and they don't know how to change the oil in a car or whatever the value system is for your, you know, your generation that you're mad about. And then if you're, you know, if you're in the younger generation, you're looking at the older generation, you're like, why aren't they keeping up with the times? They don't know anything about my life, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it just goes forever. So
I assume
all ghosts, it all evens out, you know?
I mean,
it's like we're all dead.
I feel like that's a big assumption, though, because I feel like there's going to be continued generational ghost warfare. You know what I mean? That just has to be. There's going to be stuff. There's going to be a lot of that stuff, you know?
You know, anytime you see a fantasy series about like immortal people, this kind of stuff never really comes up. They always have like a monolithic sort of culture, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's like if you are like 1,000 years old, you're an elf, and then a new baby elf. New generation of baby elves comes along. And this is now like the what, like the 50th generation of elves mm-hmm. that you've seen at this point, assuming they, you know, have kids in their 20s. I don't know elf, you know, biology.
Usually in all these fantasy settings, though, like everything slows down, you know, so like they have kids, but the kids are kids for like 100 years, you know.
Yeah, that's then,
so like they just try to scale everything so that it comes
but
out.
But even the then, like if you've been chilling for like 500 years, right, mm-hmm. and then there's this new generation of kid elves or whatever, you're gonna be kind of set in your ways, I feel, at this point, and you're not gonna be super receptive, mm-hmm. you know. To what's going on with the younger generation.
That's assuming that elves or these immortals have like the same degree of kind of, you know, neuroplasticity that we do, where they don't get quite as like, you know what I mean? Where they over time, maybe over time they actually retain that sort of childlike, maybe they're just teenagers forever, which would make them very annoying, frankly, to everyone all the time.
But that's I think like there's so many of these really weird, almost like hand wavy things that sometimes happen in fantasy with like, and they're immortal. Like these elves are immortal, right? And the implications of that just never seem to sort of manifest anywhere in the story or in the culture, other than the fact that they've been around a long time and have seen a lot of stuff. Well, hey, right? But like
Marvel's Eternals is coming out soon. And that one
has, they're probably also not going to address that question.
But we talked about how Marvel does a good job. So this will be a fun one to kind of like, you know, watch. Well,
they do a good job, not of it.
They do a good job of not answering questions.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. But you know, I feel like you'd get kind of bored after 1,000 years.
Yeah.
You know, what if the culture of elves was that they were just super bored and did not give a shit about like anything at all that was going on in the world?
You mean they become
they probably just have like really interesting hobbies and stuff, you know, because the thing that you take away when you basically just live forever is the mad rush to like
– to do anything.
To do as much as possible and like – and of course it also depends on the kind of society you've got, because if you've got a capitalist society where you're in a mad rush to have enough money that by the time you retire you can stay alive for another 30 years and live off of that, right?
Yeah,
because if you take that piece out,
you don't need to retire.
Yeah, you don't need to retire because you live forever, right? So everything is different. You can't have things like a banking system that does
compound interest,
right? True. You can't have immortality and compound interest. It already doesn't make sense that we have that, but if you now do that in the context of an immortal being, it doesn't make any sense, right?
Your society would become stratified. I mean, it already does become stratified, but we die quick enough that we can't do anything about it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. in our society.
Yeah.
Because in our society, wealth becomes stratified, but generationally in families, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's new people inheriting the wealth over and over again from their ancestors, right? But so it feels more diffuse. It's still not great. But if it was the same person, just for like 1,000 years, just continuously getting exponentially more wealthy than everybody else.
Well, imagine
you'd be like, okay, how about it's enough of that? How about that, Steve?
Well, yeah, because you just like put a dollar in on year zero, right? And then a baby born 5,000 years later, like say that's the only dollar you ever put into your savings account, right?
Yeah,
and then a baby like a born 5,000 years later, now they have to catch up, you know, to that, like,
yeah.
Which is, I guess, this is a good demonstration of the thought exercise of like if you take a thing to its logical conclusion, because there's a difference between slippery slopes and logical conclusions, right? And slippery slopes, like that goes into absurdism, but the logical conclusion is you say, well, like this is literally the same thing.
This is what
right?
would
it's
happen.
It's just instead of a person doing that, you just say this is like a family, right? But it's still the same.
Yeah. So what's the value system then of like a culture that lives forever, right? Because also
you would see the consequences of your actions, you know?
Ooh,
for a really long time.
Yeah.
Right? But only eventually, right? Which means like the older people, you know, people like 500 years old, 1,000 years old, would be really annoyed probably at all of the younger people who are making mistakes that they've made and they've seen people making like thousands of times. mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It would be, but that's like, you just take a simple premise like yeah, they just live for – they don't die. They live forever, right? It's like, okay, but that by itself is enough of a wild thing that it changes literally everything, because mm-hmm. everything in our culture and society does sort of come down to the fact that we're not here that long, and there's certain things we have to do, you yep. know, about that fact, right? So anyway, I don't know how we got there, but let's go to some questions.
Yeah.
So – you know, on this podcast, sometimes we talk about what's going on in the world. We don't really want to do that right now. sometimes we talk about what's going on in the studio, and there's a lot going on in the studio, but it's kind of complicated and doesn't make for good radio right now. Mm-hmm, okay.
And yeah, and even if it did, it's probably under NDA. And so, you know, here we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we talk about what's going on in the games industry. Well, you know, we're not going to go there.
Also,
right now.
Also not great.
So we're just vibing over here. We're just going to answer some questions from our listeners.
We could probably get out a quick PSA before we get into that, which is basically don't harass people.
It's weird. Yeah, you wash, keep just maybe wash your hands, mm-hmm. maybe get don't. Vaccinated, don't harass people.
Yeah. Can we just not
just
do
a little
that?
PSA? Little yep. Don't, just you know, don't. Yeah. Can you don't?
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. PSA over. Mm-hmm. Let's go to questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. If you want to get your question onto an episode, you can just go there and ask it, and you can vote for questions and stuff like that. So I don't know. We may be leaning more heavily into questions in the coming, you know, episodes on account of things, you know, stuff. So let's get into it. Highest upvoted question comes from Beaky Bapa Boop, the classic. Mm-hmm. Beaky Bapa Boop, who says, do you all have art hanging up in your offices? That's mm-hmm. it. That's the question.
Mm, good one.
All right. So what you got? I think this will take us about 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. We'll give it a go. So I'll hit it first.
Yeah.
No. And actually, we don't have art in our whole house, actually, and rarely have in our – like my wife's and my lives together. That was a hard thing to put into a grammatical sense.
Your
I'm not
wife
sure I succeeded. My wife's
and your
and my lives together, which is uh-huh. – anyway, don't worry about it. So it's a combo of problems. Number one, I do not parse visual information very well, so which is some combination of my ADHD, my inability to see pictures in my brain. Who knows what else? But I just can't. So there's a lot of stuff going on. My eyes literally slide off of it, and it creates sort of a low level anxiety and inability to handle things because I'm getting overloaded.
Visual stuff. Yeah.
So I like to have things be real fucking Spartan. I want as little stuff as possible. I don't want debris. You know, I need things to be just nice and but just nothing going on.
Yep. Clean.
So you take that element and then compound it with the fact, it's just still the fact that I can't see things in my brain. If I'm trying to pick something out to go somewhere.
You can't be like, would this look good in that room?
I don't know if it's going to look good because I can't – if I look at the picture, now I can't think about what it would look like on the wall. If I look at the wall, now I can't think about what the picture is that would be there, right? And then – and so because of those things, I not only don't really care because I can't, but I also kind of don't want art because of – the whole needing less visual clutter thing. So the net effect then is that if I had an external push that required me to put things up on the wall for some reason, it would have to be a very aggressive, very intense push, and I would probably just need to hire somebody to do it instead because I just literally can't.
But so even then, it would be a neutral experience for you because now you've got extra visual noise kind of in yeah. the
– It would be a net negative actually to have something go up.
Yeah.
Unless I was able to choose a thing that was somehow – because there are kinds of things that like when you look at, you can get a nice soothing experience out of, you know, that like mm-hmm. adds something without –
yeah, it doesn't have to be so busy.
Being visually complicated. So it's like a doable thing, but like the – I don't get really a gain, and so then the parameters going into it to get that thing so that it ends up being neutral at worst. It's like, why? Why would I spend my time doing that? I got stuff I want to do, you know? So that's my scenario.
Mm. Seth, what are you?
I am actually in a somewhat similar position. I didn't realize this, you know, until I learned about ADHD, but I've never wanted to have stuff on the walls. Mm. I've always wanted just – so we painted our house with different colors in each room with like really kind of bold, vibrant it's colors. Very bold. So our living room is like a deep blue. Mm-hmm. It feels like you're in the ocean, right? And when I go in that room, like that's my favorite room because it's just like the walls have a personality. Yeah. But there's nothing on them. There's just – it's totally blank walls, right? And that's it. Like, and I've never wanted to put art on them, and I – that's it. And I do have a couple of mirrors in there. Mm-hmm. Like, so I've hung up several mirrors in the house where people would normally put paintings because they add light to the space. Mm-hmm. You can check yourself out on the way past and be like, dang, nice. Right? Mm-hmm. Makes the space feel bigger, and they also kind of disappear. They're not a thing. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's it. Yeah. And then like I think the only thing I've got hanging in my office is the 12 the studio principles, or is it 13? We didn't number them, so I can't remember. but it's our studio principles and then some sound dampening panels, but even those are just completely neutral flat colors, you know. So yep. Yeah, I don't know. So, something about just I don't want clutter. I don't want to have lots of things pulling my eye. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even I have my desktop background of my computer as just completely black.
Yeah. Mine is just a nice purple color.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know I had it black for a while, but then there were times where I couldn't tell whether my like monitor was off.
Yeah. Because your desktop is also clean and like, yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing on it. Yeah. So yeah, you got to get like a little bit of color, but yeah, I really like having just nothing around.
Yeah.
So.
But it's interesting actually, because all of us have colorful wall paint because our house is we have black trim and then colorful walls and the colors change by room. So then we got this, so it's like this nice, it's called sea green or something, but it's this kind of like cute green, like light green color that's in like our kitchen and my office. And then our bedroom is like a deep red. Mm-hmm. And then my wife's office is like a pinkish kind of a color, but like
yeah, we have brown far side, more you know? Saturation in house paint than the average yeah. person. I would say.
Yeah.
But it's so cool, right? Like it's, I don't know. The idea that when you're selling your house, that it becomes more attractive to a buyer when everything is like an extremely bland white color, right? Like I get it because the colors are personal. Mm-hmm. You chose them. Where I like my office is just yellow. Like the walls are like bright yellow, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Which is like it's that's something. That's a statement. That's an mm-hmm. opinion, right?
That's very cool. Like
not everybody would want this room to be yellow, right?
I think also if you are the sort of person who wants to put stuff on the walls though, you actually will probably go for a more neutral wall. Just so you can, because that way it's easier to match stuff on the wall, right? Versus if you don't want to put stuff on the walls, it actually is much easier than to choose more bombastic colors because you're not worried about like it matching up with posters.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
But it is kind of interesting though, right? That the dominant strategy is to have a boring wall that you make interesting by putting stuff on it.
Yes.
Right. Versus having an interesting wall, and it is funny, right? Because like it's. The thing that makes it interesting is its deviation from the norm, because it's not that interesting to have a thing be a color, right? That's pretty mm-hmm. pretty straightforward.
Yeah, you can have stuff be colors. have chosen a color by choosing white, you know.
Yeah, it carries such an intense, like there's a vibe, you know.
That goes, there's a psychological effect to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Colors.
And then depending on the colors that you choose, then like the shadowing and like the contrast. So in our case, because like our doors are black and our trim is black and all that, like the contrast between those things is all like really fun and interesting. And so even though you still have just like these big swaths of wall where there's nothing going on it, right? But it's like, it's the thing that's going on is that color, but it's like very intentionally bringing in. And then now you don't have to.
Well, and we did stuff like we have, so our kitchen is teal, mm-hmm. okay, and the hallway that leads away from the kitchen that goes, you know, down to the office is fuchsia.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the living room is blue, and then we there's one place you can stand in the house where you can be in the kitchen, you can see down the hallway, and you can also see the living room, right? And it creates this interesting like green to pink to blue kind of like transition thing. And there's like one little like wall space that is creates a visual barrier between those things. And so when – so like – and you only really see that when you're standing in that spot. So we painted that a different color to create a divider, mm-hmm. right? So it's kind of like we just like have different places you stand in the house and you get different like splashes of combinations of colors.
Yeah. And it's true with Seth's house in particular. That is like because you have a lot of angles of like walls coming out and then like the root – like so all that stuff – that because each thing is literally a different color now. And like you said, you can stand in one place and see into all these rooms with these really, I mean, very different colors and very, and they're not colors where you're like, oh, I want this. I'm not going to go all the way in.
I'm going to tiptoe. I'm going to tiptoe in a few.
These are some fucking colors. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. So you're basically like your whole, the inside of your house is basically a geometric.
It's an art piece.
Color art piece, right? Yeah. It's like all about geometry and like bold. It's a big swaths of color. Yeah.
Yeah. But then like when we moved here, I was so mad. Mm-hmm. I was so mad because especially like we went into the basement and the carpet is white. There's white trim right above the carpet. The walls were white. The ceiling is white. Mm-hmm. So it's like you've got all these opportunities to make really cool and interesting sort of – like Adam was talking about having a black trim and then putting a color next to it, which is like how do we – bring out the contrast here and make kind of a cool visual mm-hmm. effect, mm-hmm. right? And so like it's still the case, like even though we painted the basement a deep purple, okay? And then it's like – and now suddenly the trim along the bottom, you know, stays white and that really like pops out from the purple and the ceiling does too. But the carpet is still this like dumb just white blob with the white trim kind of like smearing into it visually. Mm-hmm. It's like I want like a dark – deep dark carpet, you know, but we haven't done anything about that mm-hmm. fact. So that you get like a dark base and then like a flashy strip of white trim, you know, and then like a deep purple on top, right? Because it's all just about making interesting visual stuff.
Yeah, but I think largely what you guys are talking about when you talk about art on the walls is mainly the problem of noise, basically. Versus, it's not that you don't want
to
have
and having to make decisions. It's
The challenge of making those decisions. But it's not that you don't want to have an effect from, say, color or from art, quote unquote, because in the same way that this interior design stuff is itself an art form. It's just that you don't want this or the busyness. Because like in our house, so the thing is that one is I think in zones when it comes to clutter and stuff like that, I think partially it's because my wife is a visual artist as well. So she's always just like making stuff. So like my desk usually has three beverages on it in a notepad, and that's it, right?
Three full beverages or your empty bugs?
Also just depends on time of day. Could be three empty glasses of stuff, could be, you know, whatever arrangement. But there's always like three of them. So there's that. And then on my office walls themselves, I used to have, because we just got moved in, so I still don't have any on the walls here. But the plan is basically to put up very cool looking sound panels. To again, kind of because they essentially disappear in a way. They're more of like a wall piece, a change to the wall, and then to either include butterscotch related stuff. So we have some box art that we've gotten framed for the games over time and stuff like that. So kind of turn it into that sort of a space in my office in particular. And then usually I'll get like a loud zany rug, like I had a zebra rug, and not like the pattern, but literally it was like. It looked like if you asked a kid to draw a zebra, is the way I put it, and then like cut it out and turn it into a rug. Mm-hmm. It was sort of this weird looking zebra rug thing that I had in my office previously. So I love that sort of kind of weird fun stuff, but I don't actually have very much of it. And then when it comes to like being able to pay attention or not, it's for me, it's very much a zone thing. So actually as we're getting moved in here, you know, I've just asked my wife, I'm like, hey, can we just keep all like the kitchen island needs to be clear of stuff that doesn't matter. Like, don't just, like, drop stuff on it. And then if you want to just, like, put something somewhere, there's basically a sort of a quarter of this other piece of the kitchen, like, kitchen counter. And I'm like, just shit that is going in, like, a pile, just, like, put it there.
Yeah. Designate the shit pile.
Yes, the shit pile. But, like, beyond that, like, I can't – because I need to know – I basically have zones where I'm paying attention to, if that makes sense. Because I'm not going to pay attention to every single individual object because I just don't have the bandwidth for it. And so it's like – I need to know what spaces I pay attention in.
Be like, I need some shit. Let me check the shit pile. It's not in there. Well, it must not.
Yeah.
doesn't exist.
100%.
Yeah. Well, and that's true. That is the general way that ADHD works, right? Is because it's not just about trying to avoid clutter, because people with ADHD tend to make a lot of it, actually, right? And mm-hmm. part of it is because we need stuff to be visible in order for it to be a thing we know about. And so you can't have everything be visible and not have it be a little bit of a wild experience, right?
Your ideal, right, is that you have very few things, but all of them are visible all the time.
Yeah, so you know, mm-hmm. so right. you just know. Yeah. But yeah, but it's because, or at least my eyes anyway, this is pretty common for ADHD, just slide off of noisy things. Like it just, I don't, my brain's like, I don't want to deal with this. And it just, well, it just doesn't. So I just like my eyes slide off of it. And so if a mess gets created, when I first see it, it gives me anxiety. But then literally within like hours, like seeing it a few times again, my brain just doesn't even know it's there anymore because it decided not to look at it, right?
Yeah, well, because of dead zone, which is why, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so this idea, I was like, we have to declare these on purpose, because otherwise, like if it's just like a pile of stuff, you know, here, there, everywhere, then like I'm not going to know what's in the piles anymore, basically, because they're not zoned appropriately and I can't like suss it out. So the thing is that Diana loves hanging stuff on walls, like loves putting stuff up. And so we typically will pick like a few spaces that are just kind of loaded. So in our previous house, the living room had a bunch of stuff on it, and the like upstairs TV room. Basically, the spaces where usually you're just kind of hanging out. I'm not trying to like do anything. I'm just hanging out with people or whatever else. We'll decorate quite a bit, but then otherwise, most things are pretty Spartan as well. Like a mirror, you know, some plants. That's it.
Well, I think it's interesting about this question is how it's like, you know, just do you have art hanging up, right? Which the root of the question is really just like, you know, how do you decorate your space, right? And I think interestingly, yeah, we've all kind of landed in this state of not just thinking about like what to hang on the wall, but of the wall itself, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And like about
the negative space,
yeah, about sort of like thinking of the whole space as having an opinion and trying to make that entire space convey something. Actually, I have a dream of what to do with our kitchen, which is probably still like 10 years off, because apparently remodeling a kitchen costs
a lot.
Like as much Jeff Bezos level just, money.
Yeah, yeah. I understand.
So I'm kind of like, I mean, I could like start my own space program or remodel the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like where the two budget.
Yeah, we talked to somebody and they quoted us for literally like a quarter of the whole value of our house.
Yeah.
To remodel the kitchen.
And, yeah, and so – yeah, so some stuff I wonder about that is like, okay, well, if you wanted somebody to like put some tile on the floor, right? Well, what's the cost of that? Okay, something, right? Okay, if you want a new countertop, what's the cost of that? Something, right? And then if suddenly though, if you ask somebody to do all those things in one job, which you would think like, oh yeah, economies of scale, they're working in the same place. All of a sudden it's 10 times the cost because it's a kitchen. It's a magical place where money just disappears.
Really, it has to do with whether or not you're touching cabinets, because cabinets are like from a
just they take so much time.
They take so much time.
But my dream for the kitchen is to basically do like deep black tiles. Okay, white cabinet, black countertop.
Oh, interesting.
Steel appliances and keep the walls teal. Okay, mm-hmm. So you get like this like black, white, black kind of like.
I don't think bands. I've experienced a black floor. That sounds interesting.
I want it because it's also the case that the countertop that is in our kitchen is
– oh, it's speckled.
It's got like a speckled pattern on it, and you cannot see a damn thing. Like if you spill a bit of like salt or some pepper or some spice or some sauce or anything.
I've lost spoons on your counter. I put a spoon down and then it gets gone because it's like it's in the camouflage zone. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a catch-22 because you're like, well – that way I can be like, oh, I don't really care if my countertop is dirty because I can't see it, right? Except like I do care if it's dirty and I want to keep it clean.
Well, yeah, it's like the difference between wearing like so I got some house shoes and I ordered them in black first and I got them and I put them on. The moment I put them on, a single cat hair descended and landed on it. And it was like a visual beacon, right? And I was like, okay, yeah, this can't work. So I got like this gray one that has a texture with a little bit of like darker and lighter gray, right?
Yep.
So that like you can still see cat hair on it, but it's not the same sort of like draws your eye to it kind of a deal. And like, and that's supposed to be the goal of these things too, right? Is that because our counter is the same deal with like the speckled, really, really visually noisy pattern. So that stuff gets lost there. And the idea, I assume, is that that way, if like, if there's a little bit of like a water
a bits mark of dust or
something, some dust on there, that it's not just like swinging your eyes onto it, you know. But well, it is true. You want that surface to be clean.
So, yeah, I'm worried about that though, with like getting a black floor, you know, because then it's like, okay, yeah, like,
oh yeah.
You're gonna see dust,
everything.
Whatever. But now we also have the contrast problem, because now we have a dog with orange hair and a dog with black hair, and now like
you can't win like, with
one,
anything now.
Yeah, one dog is like hanging out on the black couch and gone. Leaving orange, obviously orange hair on there, right? And another dog, our black dog, lays on this white bed, and suddenly now you can see black hairs all over the white bed. And it's like shit.
Yep.
I mean, there was always a lot of dog hair everywhere on everything, but at least we couldn't see some of it. You know? Now we've got the contrast going on. So anyway, you guys want to get on to the next question?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay. Next question comes from Alawaka Kamiya.
Nice.
Who says, we haven't heard anything on Shenanicon 2021. Is that something that's still in the mix, or is it out? You guys rock.
Thank you.
That's not happening.
That's not happening. So Shenanicon was a really fun time, mm-hmm. and I really enjoyed it. But we also – it took a lot of work and time, and we kind of hit a point where we were like, we want to hit pause on this thing and think about doing it again if we hit a point where, A, we can be sure that there would actually be like – it would be like a big deal. Mm-hmm. Right, as in, like, we want to make a game, kind of like look internally, refocus, and try to make a game or games or an IP that has such a huge following behind it that we could throw an event like a Shenanicon and have it be just like a much, much bigger thing, right? Because part of the problem is if you have an event that has like 30 to 50 people coming, then the economies of scale of organizing that event are very low, right? Like each person that you host at the event is very expensive to plan for and accommodate. And so just kind of a point where like it was just a really expensive and difficult thing to plan for the scale that it was. And so we were going to be hitting pause on it anyway, but then like I guess something happened in 2020.
Yeah.
And it's sort of still going on, especially where, you know, in Missouri. So, you know, we're just chilling. And if we decide to do it again, then, you know, we'll definitely be very public about it, and everybody will hear about it, because we, you know, we won't shut up about it at that point.
I think the trouble is always
no regrets from doing it. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. But there's
got to be stuff to, you know, to do, right? And to talk about. And there has to be a reason. There has to be stuff, right? Especially because like people come from all over and it's really expensive for people to take the time and do the traveling and all of that. And so, so having that event, like it always, there's so much pressure for it to feel like it's worth it.
We want everybody to have a good time and
and it's hard to do. And then you kind of go like in the part where like we're an early dev on Crashlands 2, which isn't like officially announced in a very public way. There's no marketing materials out in the world, no art out in the world. You know, we don't know what platforms it's going to be on because we're still having all of those discussions. So there's nothing we can like say.
We can't show it.
We can't show it. Mm-hmm. And so like what would, you know, so like, so the next, you're now trying to plan the next Shenanicon would be like, we'd be in the middle of trying to keep dev going and keep all these like biz dev balls juggling and all this stuff. And then also trying to have an event where we're like, but why though? what are we going to do?
Well, what I think is also kind of interesting about this idea of like having a convention as a game studio is so much of the content of those conventions is that sort of like either ongoing stuff. So for example, if you have a live service game that's like maybe like a PvP game or whatever, where it has an active player base that is just engaging with the game all the time, right? So if you think about even like Minecraft, right? Like they have their MineCon thingy. It's a sandbox game. It's heavily modded, and the developer, I guess, which is not Microsoft, like they didn't really have to do anything to keep the community involved, because the community makes themselves involved via modding and stuff like that. So they can have MineCon every year, just in perpetuity, and people will go and be pumped about it, right? But on the flip side, one of the other big studios that does big conventions is Blizzard with BlizzCon, right? And their last few BlizzCons have been kind of dicey, because their pace of content release has slowed down, and also they're trying to change their target markets to more mobile oriented stuff. And they've literally been like booed at their own convention. Like they announced Diablo Immortal because everybody at BlizzCon is a PC gamer because Blizzard games have been PC for so long. And as soon as Diablo comes up, people are like, oh my God, it's going to be Diablo 4, right? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly it's, oh yeah, it's actually this mobile game that we're not even making. We're actually outsourcing the development of it to another company. Mm-hmm. Who is famous for making like microtransaction riddle. Like, and it's just like the details just keep making it worse and worse to the point where this was the convention where when they opened up for questions after the announcement, a guy came up to the mic and he asked if this was an out of season April Fool's joke. And the response was just bad, right? And so one of the difficulties with those kinds of like having a convention as a game studio is your existing fan base is there for like the content that you have released in the past and looking forward to sort of like iterations of the same, you know? And if you're doing something that A, takes a long time, like let's say they're working on Diablo 4, or maybe they have been working on it for 5 years, but they still don't have anything to show yet, right? Well, they're not going to want to talk about it at BlizzCon, so they got to sit on it and keep quiet, right? Which means that part of the convention kind of sucks, right?
It was just tricky because you want to give people what they want is basically what it comes down to. But the reality of like running a studio is that you can't give people what they want at specific times that are also like extremely logistically calculated. I think
in a way, it's a lot like making a like an E3 build, right? Where you have to all of a sudden like get everybody on board to make a thing specifically for that purpose and divert all of the resources and attention away from the actual product itself to do that and create that thing to, you know, to convey this experience to people. And that's how you deliver on a timeline like that, right? To a specific audience, because that audience is not the same as the audience they're literally selling the game to. It's a different purpose. Because they're trying to sell the spectacle of an event, which is just not the same. And so doing that with in the middle of development on a timeline, it's extremely costly. It's like extremely costly, and the end result is just not going to be what everybody wants. You know,
it can't be. And I think a convention like that can do well if like because they have like StarCraft, Diablo, Warcraft, and Overwatch as kind of like their four main IPs. And so if any given year they held their convention and they had like some big news about, two out of the four, right? Then like that's pretty good, right? But like Adam was noting, that does require an incredible amount of coordination and also planning to make sure that those projects are at a state that can be shown and that they work properly.
It impacts dev. And I think
it impacts development a lot.
Yeah. And the reality for us is completely different because like we don't just show up at the convention because we're also running the convention and planning the convention and assisting with the logistics of it.
Right.
Yeah. So Blizzard has a team and a program outsources a bunch of stuff too, right?
So for us, actually, like dev sort of like pauses while we're planning the convention, but also development has to be built around the convention so that we have stuff to show at the convention, right? So it's like it's pretty hard.
It was very tricky to do. As much fun as it was, like honestly, I did the sort of shoutcasting for our Levelhead tournament in person at the last Shenanigan, which was so fun and like. That was just
a convention was a blast. Just that the like 2 to 3 weeks of work in advance of it is just so much. Just a lot.
So much time.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got time for one last question. So this question comes from Unanimously, who says, which I guess is when like everyone agrees on something except for maybe like
a person,
one or two people, who says, a fairly highly anticipated indie game, Axiom Verge 2, did a surprise release the other day. Oh. That seems like more of a risk to me, but I don't know. Maybe if you're feeling cute after being bankrolled by a sugar daddy corp, it makes sense. What do you guys think of surprise releases? So I think, did they release on Epic? Is that it?
They did. Yeah. So it's, I looked up a little bit.
So that must be the Sugar Daddy Corp reference there.
Yep. Yeah. So they're Epic exclusive, but also on Switch and then I think something else, or they're coming to PlayStation soon or something like that. So yeah, I think my two cents on, we refer to it as Beyoncé-ing because Beyoncé dropped, I think it was the Lemonade album in like 2016 or 17 or something, just out of nowhere.
Beyoncé as a verb is to to release a product with no advance fanfare or warning, just like drop it.
The reason why it's important to use Beyoncé as the term here is because
are you Beyoncé?
Exactly. Yeah. Are you Beyoncé?
What level are you at?
What level are you at? Because like she could do that, sure, 100%. But can you? Really?
Well, her doing that is itself such a big news item because she can't leave her house without creating news. You know, it's not possible. So doing something like that is its own deal, right?
Yeah, and actually, in her case, she has the opposite problem, which is everybody is way too interested in everything she's true. Doing.
Yes. Yeah,
and if she were to like. Periodically make a series of announcements, you know, about her upcoming album, then actually that removes the intrigue of like, what is she up to? What's she doing? Right.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're like, also, because it's Ukraine,
because people are so hungry. Yep. So they're so hungry for information that by not saying anything about the album, she increases anticipation about it. When's her next album coming? It's got to be coming at some point.
Yeah. Because you create a moment, right? That people can share and talk about. So it's a really good strategy if you believe well, I guess if there's two conditions. One is if you believe that there's sufficient hype and interest around the game such that you suddenly releasing it will in particular cause a lot of word of mouth to happen because of the sudden release. Because essentially
it's a big deal that it was released.
Yeah. And what's exciting about that is that gives people, your fans and players, the opportunity to be the person who tells someone else that it's available. Which is awesome, right? So being the person who's like, oh shit, you guys, Beyonce's album just dropped. Like you get to be that person, right? Which is amazing and super fun. Like as far as like creating a moment for your fans is really fun. Or if it's the case that you aren't actually particularly concerned about creating the sort of roll-up fervor that typically is accompanied with video games. So typically in video games, the marketing wisdom is you're supposed to like, people are supposed to know the launch date, like, you know, 3-6 months in advance, and then like there's sort of little new tidbits and stuff that just keep coming out to kind of supposedly build this hype fire, right?
Yeah, nobody knows, and there's counterexamples for everything. The problem is you can't do these as experiments because you just spent if you're a AAA studio, you just spent $300 million making a game, right? Mm-hmm. Are you going to experiment on the marketing and launch techniques, or are you going to just do it the way you always have? And because at least that didn't obviously do anything bad, right?
Yes.
And of course, that's what you're going to do.
And every game's unique. So what works for one game? I mean, if like Cyberpunk did it, so I'm going to do it. Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. I don't know. Is that a good move? I don't know.
Yep.
Nobody knows.
I think when it comes to because this is where the funny piece of it comes with the question, which is the sugar daddy thing. Because the thing is, if you're not necessarily concerned about having to actually generate so much hype, then you can do more experimental stuff for one. As in, like, you don't have to do things by the book in a way that desperately tries to maximize the impact on day one based on supposedly known or best practices, right? You could do something like just try launching it and see if that works because you do already have guaranteed funding. So as much as it's true that like, yeah, of course, like they're getting paid by Epic for the exclusivity, you have to recognize what that actually allows the devs to do, which is either experiment in terms of the marketing stuff. And that can look a billion different ways. I'm not saying that this was an experiment on purpose. This could have also just been like, we already got money, so it's fine. However, I doubt that in terms of if they're dealing with platform partners and stuff, I doubt that just being like, yeah, we're just going to like punt it out on Thursday. It was a conversation. It was probably
also think about this. If this game is launching as an Epic exclusive, if they announce that in advance,
yes,
that has just as much potential to create
They did though. The thing is like I think in February they announced that it was going to be an Epic exclusive. The news article I've seen, which of course did generate some
negative success. Feedback.
And the devs were like, literally the guy was like, Axiom Verge originally was a side project that I did for fun. And then it became my job and I have a family. So you know what that means, which is like, I would like to know that I'm not going to die after this thing comes out because it didn't make any money. So signing the deal with Epic just made a lot
of sense. So yeah, you're going to take the deal. Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
And anybody can download the Epic Launcher and buy it and play it.
Yeah, it's fine. Like,
it's fine.
It's just fine. And so yeah, I think my feeling on Beyonce drops is that you have to you can only do it from a position of strength, like a true position of strength, and believe that something good is going to happen from it. I think otherwise you are probably too confident, and I think that goes for almost every single person who does it, except for Beyonce.
If you are just releasing a game, then you have to understand like who you're releasing it to, right? And if you know that there is a massive crowd of people just with their outstretched hands just waiting for you to plop this game into their hand, right? Then like, hell yeah,
mm-hmm.
just release it. Who cares, right? But if there's even like a question about whether there are people anticipating this game, then they're probably not. They're probably not anticipating it. They've got a lot of stuff going on in their lives, right? And so like because you also have to think about the disruption potential of this, which is if you have a game that you want people to really like sink their teeth into and spend a lot of time with and whatnot, then sometimes people need to know, like, do I need to take a day off? Do I need to have a weekend? Do I need
to plan this thing? Just to plan your weekend with it, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, imagine if suddenly Half-Life 3 came out, just suddenly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Next Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There would be the responses would be, oh my God, Half-Life 3 came out. It's all anybody would be able to talk about. But also, like, you personally would want to get in on this potentially if you're part of that, like, I want, you know, Half-Life 3 needs to exist hype train. And you would think, like, maybe I should take tomorrow off of work, right? So I could just play this damn thing. Mm-hmm. It's going to be disruptive.
Problem is that all these can go anyway, though, right? Because, like, yeah. If they launch it on a Tuesday and now like you can't get it, and it's all everybody's talking about, it's all anybody can talk about.
So now you're like, consuming all this content about it.
Yeah, you're just like waiting until the weekend before you can, you know, or your next day off or whatever, or you're calling in sick the next day, you know, like whatever. But like, and that in itself is not going to generate all that. Because what all this comes down to is a question of how can you get visibility on your game, right? Yes. That's the whole thing. That's what marketing. It's what launches. It's all about how do you get eyeballs on your thing and the right eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning the people who would want it, and how do you get the visibility to them at the right time, so that, and it all depends on who the people are, right? Because to like the thing about Beyonce, right? A Beyonce fan, as a person who thinks about Beyonce, like a kind of a large amount of their life, right? Mm-hmm. They listen to her music. It's always like they're constantly being reminded of this fandom that they participate in.
Yeah, their eyeballs are already pointed at the next album, there. Even when it doesn't exist. They're pointed at this empty space where that next album is supposed to be.
Yeah, and they're not going to forget that Beyonce exists. That's not going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. If you're Half-Life 3, same deal, right? Like the fervor for that franchise is so deep, and it's lasted for, what, 25 years or whatever?
Now, 2004 years. Was Half-Life 2, so like coming up on the 20-year mark.
So this has been there for so long that like – and when people still today, like, when people ask me what my favorite game is, like it's still always going to be Half-Life 2 because that was so formative, you know, when it came out. And so it's the same deal. Like they could drop that game and it would be nothing, right? But for most games though, in particular indie games, because they're smaller, it's the stuff that people play. Like the audience for them isn't that big anyway, but the people who play indie games tend to play a lot of them. Indie games usually don't consume a whole person's life for years on a stretch, you know? And as a consequence, like your game comes into visibility at launch and then kind of goes out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like if it's a good game and people really like it, there will be a fandom there who's still thinking about it, still plays it every once in a while, still waiting for the next title to come out. But it's not that big of a pool who's like just all where you're already visible. And so launch and post-launch success, because like there's no reason why launch has to be where all your success is, right? There's not like a fact of the universe where it's like launch, but it's because that's when you get eyeballs, because that's where all the
– That's when your game is news, actually. That's why it's
– Yeah. That's when and that's also how all the storefronts work, because the storefronts feature things when they come out and they algorithmically surface things with a decay function that makes it harder and harder to get visibility the longer the game has been out, right? And so that's the reason that everything is about the launch day. It's not something magic, right, about that. So the question is always for your game, for your audience, for where you're putting it, for the people who it's for, who are those people? Are they already waiting? Where are they? And when you're going to launch it, what kind of participation are you going to get from the platforms? It's just always about visibility. And so to Sam and Seth's point, if you just have that visibility already, you can just launch it.
Dude, I fucking
Beyonce.
But I think there's another, and like, and you guys got into this a little bit, but I think there is that more cynical side of it, which is not only if you can do that, then, you know, you can, but also maybe you should, because if you already have a large fandom and they're already waiting for it, there's like a fandom that is large just has large toxic components, right? That's, you can look
it's
at
got
it.
Large, look at it's got them. Large everything.
It's got large everything.
Right? Yeah.
And there's a subset of people who will start fomenting, you know, hypotheses about what this all means. Like, you give them the tiniest little drop of something, a little early piece of news, right? And now all of a sudden you turn around and you look 6 months later, and there's like this intense rabid fan base who, if you do not deliver that thing that they believe that you promised them, you know, like off goes your head, right?
I think equivalent in music is like you slightly change the sound or the vibe, right, of the music you make on the next album. Equivalent in games is you change the system in like a sequel where you change like the control input or something like that. Mm-hmm. And people can, before a game comes out, will lose their shit getting really mad about
thinking about how you've ruined it when they can't experience it yet.
Yeah.
And they'll just be fermenting these ideas, right? Mm-hmm. And so with a really intense fandom, there's actually more to lose, I think, than there is to gain by having early announcements that actually provide information, because the more information they provide, because it can never be experiential until somebody gets the game in their hands.
Honestly, Diablo Immortal. Like, so Fallout did this, where suddenly they were like,
"Hey,
everybody!"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were like, "Hey, everybody! Hey, Fallout 4 is coming!" And also, just literally right now,
just open up
your phone, and you can get a new like dope ass Fallout mobile game that's now available. Right. Yep. So there's not a single moment where people could in advance speculate about how Bethesda is like ruining everything about Fallout.
And how terrible this game is.
Mobile studio.
Blah, blah.
Yeah, because they were just already playing the game and it was fun, right?
They could just go play it. Yeah.
Yeah, but also they paired it with an announcement that does serve their core fan base in the domains that they're already in, right? And so like, so if, for example, Diablo Immortal had just been handled that way, where they just, instead of, because they teased it, like they teased a mobile game.
Yeah.
And so if instead they were like, "Hey, everybody, we're working on Diablo 4, but in the meantime, how would you feel about having Diablo in your pocket?" Yeah. Well, you've got it now because it's already available.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go get it.
Yeah, that would have only been something people were excited about, right? But
cuz then though, people think about it as like, "Oh, this is a fun thing to tide me over with, get my Diablo fix until Diablo 4." Instead, now it's like, "Well, now I'm waiting for this thing and waiting for the other thing."
Yeah, just waiting for all of these things.
Yeah, I was waiting for
sitting around. It depends on the audience, right? Because it's not inherently bad to announce a mobile title, right? That doesn't make any sense. It's announcing a mobile title to a PC-focused audience who's waiting for a new PC game, right?
With no other news.
With no other news. Like that doesn't work.
That was rough.
That was not a good plan. And that's the nuance with all of this, right? There's not like, "Oh, here's how you launch a game." The question is,
everything's a gamble.
Who is it for? Who could be interested? Where can you get visibility? And then what is your strategy now to capture that visibility? And if you're an indie, that usually is going to mean as much information as you can as early as possible, so that you're rolling the dice over and over again, just over and over, rolling the dice, right? Trying to find people who are interested enough that you're just building. You're building visibility, and you're building that slowly over time with the added little dash of hope that like you catch somebody's attention who can make a really big difference. Because you can't, as an indie, especially an unknown one, you can't just go launch a game. You can't just go put it live on Steam, right? Mm-hmm. You can't. There's no system in place that will make it so that that gives you a success, unless your game is so incredibly like interesting.
And it's not. I'm just going to be honest. It's not.
It's not.
It is. Don't even. Just don't even fucking go there. Because like, yeah, this is my problem.
Yeah, you shouldn't do it. Yes, that's true.
Yeah, you get so close to it and you're like, oh my God, like maybe I'm just dreaming of money. Like I'm dreaming of all these players. And like its context is so important for the moment of your launch that even if you have the game that is just like, oh my God, so slick and amazing and whatever, it just doesn't matter if you just put it out there. Yeah. Yep. And so, yeah, I would.
Well, actually, this is a good point too, because like, yeah, to that point, I see, I guess historically, we've seen a lot of indies who are kind of on the hobbyist side, but like trying to get into it, like working on a game, getting it close to a point where they feel like, oh, maybe I could go early access with this, maybe I could go ahead and launch it, to the point where they just start getting tired of it not being launched. And then they have this idea that, okay, well, if I just get it out now, then I can keep on adding to it later once there are players there, once I'm, you know, pulling in some money for it and whatever. And the reality is that's not what's going to happen. You're going to put it out now and then nobody's going to buy it, because the problem wasn't it not being available to buy. The problem is
no one knows it exists
to buy it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's like writing the first, you know, two-thirds of your novel, you know, and being like, well, I mean, I'll release this, you know, and I'll see if there's
interest. I'll use that to finish it.
Yeah, I'll see if there's interest, and I'll update the ebook and get those last few chapters. It's like, that's not gonna get a good response there. Nope. All right, well, that's all the time we have for this week. Very good questions, so thank you for asking. And of course, go to podcast.beesguys.net, ask more questions, and we'll answer them. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Costa, for putting the podcast together, and thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.